Don Machholtz, and you are listening to Looking Up with Don. This is the Looking Up with Don podcast, episode number 5, for the week of February 5th, 2020. The related website for this podcast is donmachholtz.com. That is spelled donmachholz.com. Two H's. What's up in the sky this week? As our week begins on Wednesday, February 5th, the moon is in gibbous phase, that is bright and high, in our evening eastern sky. It reaches the full moon phase on the evening of February 8th and 9th, that is, this weekend. By next Tuesday, February 11th, the moon will be rising about 3 hours after sunset. This is a good time to get out and watch and or photograph the moonrise over your horizon. In the evening this week, you'll see the planet Venus in the southwest. Its neighbor, the planet Mercury, makes a favorable appearance beginning this weekend for a few days. Look for it in the western sky about 45 minutes after sunset, before the sky darkens much. If you wait too long, Mercury will be too low in the sky because it sets 90 minutes after sunset. And if you're out too early, you'll lose it in the bright twilight. Face the west, and Mercury will appear as a star, fairly bright between Venus and the sunset point on your horizon. There's nothing else that bright in the area, so if you see a bright star, that is the planet Mercury. After you've spotted Mercury, then look up at Venus and look down at the Earth. You have now seen the first three planets in our solar system. And while you're out in the evening sky, don't forget to look to the east and check out the red star Betelgeuse. It's in the constellation Orion. It has been dimmer than usual. There's some reports that it might be beginning to brighten, but I'm not sure that that's actually happening yet. You can still make estimates of its brightness and see for yourself. To make those estimates, use StarMap 1 from Podcast 5, that's this podcast, which has the magnitudes of some of the stars written on the map. In the morning sky this week, you'll find the planet Jupiter low in the southeast. Comet Iwamoda, that is Comet 2020A2, is now magnitude 11 and moving northward through the morning sky at about 1.7 degrees per day. It passes by the star Vega on February 8th, but the moon will be bright and on the opposite side of the sky at that time. With a bright moon this week, let's see if we can photograph it through a telescope with a cell phone. I first heard of this a few years ago, and I've had some success photographing the moon with my cell phone. When I saw that I could do it, I invited others. At our public star parties, we invited the public to take photos of the moon through our telescopes, and this allowed the guests to take home a couple of photos of the moon. Most of our guests found this to be quite inspiring. They do make cell phone camera mounts to attach your cell phone to the telescope. But for this exercise, we don't really need this. If you have one, use it. But you don't need it for the moon. The method we will use is known as the afocal method, also known as the eyepiece projection method. You keep the eyepiece in the telescope using low power and focus it so that the image of the moon is sharp. If you need glasses to see far distances well, put on your glasses to focus the telescope. Then, turn off the flash for your camera. Yes, we've had people try to photograph the moon through the telescope with the flash on, and it just doesn't work very well. Also, you might have a setting on your camera which allows you to take a photo merely by saying something like, smile, or shoot. Go to your camera settings and look for something like shooting methods. If you have an Apple iPhone, Siri might be able to snap the picture for you. If you have this feature, engage that. Initially, we're going to be using the automatic settings that come on your camera on your cell phone. The moon is bright, and this is similar to daylight photography. Now comes the toughest part, lining up your camera's lens to the eyepiece. For a good photo, it has to be centered on the light coming out of the eyepiece, and the camera has to be perpendicular to the light path coming out of the eyepiece. By looking at your camera screen, you can center it until you get a good image. But be patient. This might take a while. You'll have to bring your cell phone directly up to the eyepiece, touching it in many cases. Most cell phones allow you to touch the screen with your finger, and it will readjust the exposure and the focus. If so, touch it on the moon's image and readjust the brightness. If you do not do that, the photo will probably be overexposed. Take several photos. You can place it as wallpaper on your cell phone. You can download them to a computer and further process them if you wish. And then invite your friends and family to also shoot moon photos through your telescope. There are some apps that are available for nighttime photography, and in a future podcast, we'll be talking about shooting the stars, the Milky Way, and so on with your cell phone. The International Space Station this week is visible in the evening sky for the Northern Hemisphere. After this week, it will more than likely not be visible until mid-February when we pick it up in the morning sky. Meanwhile, the Southern Hemisphere can see it in the morning sky now. For those near the equator, plus or minus 15 degrees, you'll probably not be able to see it until early next week. Go to the website heavens-above.com, enter your location, and find out where and when to see it. You can also use the heavens-above.com website to find out where and when the latest, that is the fourth, set of Starlink satellites, which is known as Starlink 3, will be visible. Then go out and have a look. Our unaided eye challenge for this week is that we are going to learn another constellation. Last week it was the constellation Auriga. This week it's the constellation Orion. Orion is fairly high in your eastern sky a couple hours after sunset from most latitudes. Half the constellation is north of the equator, and half is south. Orion is a hunter, and it does look something like a hunter. His shoulders and knees are made up of four bright stars. He has a belt made up of three stars and a sword just south of the belt. With dark skies, you might be able to also notice his arms leading up to the west and to the north. The belt lines up with a couple of bright stars. If you draw a line through the belt and go northward, we get to the bright star Aldebaran. And going south, we are led to the brightest star in the sky, Sirius. So here we are, the constellation Orion, one of the brightest and most familiar constellations in the sky. Get to know Orion well. For the binocular challenge this week, we're going to look at three stars, and each one is a different color. The color of the star is an indication of the surface temperature of the star. Sometimes people think that the color has to do with what's known as the red shift or a blue shift, and they'll see a red star and they'll say, oh, that must be red shifted, and a blue star must be blue shifted. Actually, the color has nothing at all to do with whether the star is moving away from us or toward us. It does have to do with the surface temperature of the star. Red stars are the coolest, and blue stars are the hottest. Yellow stars are somewhere in between. Now, when a star is faint, you don't see the color because you're seeing it with the more sensitive rods in your eyes. The rods see in black and white. The other part of your eye's retinas is called the cones. They are less sensitive to light, but they see in color. They are active in daylight and strong light, while the rods, which you see only in black and white, are active in dim light. A star that is bright or one that you brighten by using binoculars or a telescope will show color. Let's begin with the red star first. Now, the stars we will look at are labeled on the map you can get from my website. The map is Podcast 5, Star Map 1. Our red star this week is Betelgeuse. It is a variable star, which means it varies in brightness, and it's been in the news lately because it has been dimming. It is a red giant, swollen, very large in size, and the surface temperature is about 5,800 degrees Fahrenheit, or 3,200 degrees Celsius. This is a slow burn. It's located about 650 light years from us, and it's in the constellation Orion. So take a look at it. Even though it's a large star, it's very far away, so even through binoculars, it will just appear as a tiny point of light that's very bright. For the blue star, we're actually going to pick three stars, and they are the three stars in the belt of Orion. So after you've had a good look at Betelgeuse, swing over a few degrees and pick up the belt of Orion. All three of those stars are blue. Now, these are hot stars. They're at about 55,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 30,000 degrees Celsius. They are 20 times more massive than our sun and burning rapidly. They're located at various distances from us, between 700 and 1,300 light years away. For the yellow star, we're going to look at the star Capella. It is in the constellation Auriga, and it's nearly overhead a couple hours after sunset from the mid-northern hemisphere. Notice the yellow color. The temperature of Capella is about 9,100 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 5,000 degrees Celsius. It's 43 light years away. Now, lower your binoculars and look for the colors of Betelgeuse, the stars in the belt of Orion, and Capella. With the unaided eye, can you see the color differences? Our telescopic challenge this week is the double star Almach, spelled A-L-M-A-C-H. It sometimes is spelled A-L-M-A-A-K. It's known as the star Gamma in the constellation Andromeda. It's labeled on Star Map Number 1, Podcast 5. This is one of the prettiest double stars in the sky. These evenings, it's high in the northwestern sky, and through a telescope, you'll see two stars. But there are two more as a secondary star, that is a fainter star, is actually a triple star. That makes four stars in all, but again, you'll see only two. The system is about 400 light years away, and the stars take 4,800 years to go around each other. So don't sit there waiting to see them move. The magnitudes of the two stars are 2.3 and 4.8, meaning that one is about 10 times brighter than the other. The interesting thing and the beautiful thing about this double star is that the colors contrast with the brighter star being yellow or golden in color. As for the fainter one, many say that it is blue. But to me, the other night, it looked more like it was green. They are separated from each other by about 9 arc seconds, meaning that you'll need at least 50 power to split them. So take a look at them this week. What colors do you see? Let me know in the comments below. Now let's have some fun with the marathon. The Messier Marathon is a yearly activity to observe all or nearly all of the 110 galaxies, clusters, and nebula in the Charles Messier catalog in one night. Now the best time to do this, the best chance you have of seeing all of them, is in late March of each year. Now this year, many will be doing this on March 28th. To successfully run the marathon, it helps to have an observing order. I observed one in 1978, refined it over the years, and it's very helpful in systematically finding as many of the Messier objects that the sky allows you to see. You can download the Messier Marathon search sequence from my website. It is Podcast 5 MM Search Sequence. You might also wish to download Podcast 5 Map 2, which shows the Messier objects that we'll be discussing this week. Let's take a small tangent, then we'll get back to the search sequence. The idea of the Messier Marathon is to find and observe the Messier objects. Two points about this that are necessary to be made, and these are very important. First, you must actually observe or see the object in your telescope. You can see it with direct vision, that is, looking directly at it, or with averted vision, looking a bit off to the side of the field of view, but concentrating on the object centered in the field of view. Either one works. With some of these objects, you might find the correct field of view, meaning you found it, but it may not be visible to you because it's too low in the sky, or the twilight is still too bright, or your eyesight is not good, or your telescope doesn't gather enough light, or there is haze, fog, or cloud in the sky. If you do not see it, then you cannot count it as being observed. Very early in the marathon days, I was asked if every marathon should have a checker, an advanced observer who would go from telescope to telescope to make sure each observer actually was on each object. This is how it would work. When you found M31, for instance, you would call out for the checker who would go to your telescope, take a look, and say either, yes, you have it, or no, you don't. I realized that this would really slow down the marathon and would not allow someone to do the marathon on their own. The person being the checker would also have a very busy 9-hour night, and observers would sometimes have to wait for the checker to show up. I decided that the best way to do this, and this is the way most people handle the marathon, is to have each astronomer on the honor system. Every observer is trusted to be honest. In practice, this has worked very well. However, there is an instance where a large group was doing the Messier Marathon one night, and one observer was the only one to see one of the Messier objects, an object which everyone else failed to see, and calculation showed that it was just below the horizon when he supposedly observed it. The other important thing is about finding the Messier object. How do you find them? In the early days, many astronomers star hopped to the object. They began by pointing their telescope to a bright star near the object, and then nudged and pushed and pulled their telescope a few degrees this way and that, finally centering on the Messier object. Some astronomers back then had what was known as setting circles. If the telescope and setting circles were aligned, the observer could rotate the axes of the telescope until the setting circles showed the coordinates of the Messier object, and the object would then be in their telescopic field of view. In the years since, telescopes have become more sophisticated. Now, probably at least half the telescopes that amateur astronomers have boast electronic setting circles, and many of them have motors on both the axes to drive the telescope to the selected object. So they simply have to enter, find M74, or in some cases just say it, and the telescope would move across the sky until M74 is in the center of the field of view. This is easy, and some have the opinion that this is cheating to use such an easy means to find the Messier object. Early on, I was asked by one of the other inventors of the Messier Marathon if such instrumentation should be allowed for the Messier Marathon. I had to ponder that for a while, because if we were to say, you cannot use setting circles and electronic means, then we would lose a lot of astronomers, many of whom know of no other way to find celestial objects. The Messier marathon would die out in a generation as these star hoppers passed away. Why should we disallow someone from running the marathon just because they have never learned to star hop? On the other hand, it is more difficult to find the objects without electronic means, and the disadvantage is enhanced when the sky is partly cloudy. This has happened to me at the All-Arizona Messier Marathon when a mostly cloudy sky greeted us. The electronic guys simply pointed their telescope to where the Messier object is and wait for a hole in the clouds to see it, then move on. Those of us who star hop usually need a larger hole in the clouds and a minute or two to find our guide star, then hop over to the Messier object. This all had to be done as the clouds were moving across the sky. The astronomers with the electronic setting circles would see objects that I was unable to find and see. The disadvantage is also greater in the twilight sky, where the guys with electronic finding equipment automatically go to the Messier object and wait for it to appear, rather than star hopping through sometimes faint stars in a twilight sky to get to the Messier object. That is especially important in the morning sky, when the last object, M30, rises in the southeastern sky near twilight. So what to do? At the time, the Ventura County Astronomical Society, VCAS, was very active in running the Messier Marathon each year. They had two different categories for the marathon, one for those using electronic setting circles and the other for those who don't. This has always seemed to be fair to me. I know of no other club, though, that does it this way. This is something like the story of John Henry, Man Against Machine. One of the major astronomy magazines once had a contest between the manual method and the electronic method. And to my recollection, the electronic method won by one object. But it does depend upon who is doing the manual method. After some thought, I suggested we make it clear that electronic setting circles are perfectly acceptable for the Messier Marathon. The observing order can be the same as what is widely published. That being said, it is more difficult to find the objects manually than with electronic setting circles. And yes, I have been to Messier marathons where I did not see all the objects, while those with the advanced equipment did, and they beat me. Instead of visually seeing the Messier objects, some amateurs who are involved in imaging will also do the marathon. In the early days, they used photography with real film. I remember how they started marathoning a few years after we started doing them visually and lagged behind us a bit. It took a while for someone to photograph all 110 objects, but in recent decades, CCDs have come on board and they're more sensitive and can be used in stronger twilight than photographic film. That, plus electronic setting circles and automated telescopes, has made the Messier Marathon much easier for the astronomers with a CCD setup. They often outpace the visual marathoners. Because the playing field is uneven, and it is uneven due to, as we have said, equipment, but also experience and even the willingness to complete the marathon, the term competition is usually put aside or given less emphasis. Let me expand. Some who come to the Messier Marathon are only interested in doing the evening objects or perhaps none at all. This initially bothered me a bit in our early marathons when maybe 10 out of 30 amateur astronomers at the Messier Marathon even bothered to start, and only two or three were still awake in the morning to finish it. But then I thought, hey, get over it, Don. This is a club star party. People are having fun and socializing and seeing the sky tonight. Some doing their own projects, and not everyone is going to be interested in the Messier Marathon. Just do what you can and don't compare yourself to others. As I've said for many years, some of the happiest marathoners the following morning are those who saw a limited number of objects, but it was the first time they have ever found and observed them. Now back to the Messe Marathon search sequence. To follow along, go to my website, donmockels.com, and download Podcast 5, Star Map 2, and Podcast 5, MM Search Sequence. Originally, I set up the search sequence using a popular star atlas named Atlas of the Heavens. One would take out one of the star atlas charts, find and observe the objects on that chart, then pull the next chart and find the objects on that chart, and so on. In the early 1980s, I made a search sequence with maps for each object and directions from one to the next. It was a small booklet. I used that for many years, refining it and making notes on it each time I ran the marathon. This was the basis for the Atlas section of my two books on the Messe Marathon. Nowadays, and as I said, you can download it, the Messe Marathon search sequence is all stated on one page. This search sequence works for mid-northern latitudes for late March. Search sequences can be made for other times of the year. I've made a few, and they're not that difficult to create. The key is to find the objects in the western sky before they set and work your way across the sky. In the morning, you pick up your final objects down near the eastern horizon as they rise. But it is also important to work in one part of the sky, say the northern part, before swinging south to pick up a batch of additional objects. Some search sequences have you running all over the western sky after sunset, not getting the most vital items until later in the search. The search sequence here on my website will take you comfortably through the Messe objects. You can deviate from it if high horizons or a tree or some other obstruction gets in the way, but be sure you go back to the object at a later time. Seasoned Messe marathoners who analyze a search sequence will see that it is made up of strings of objects. The first one is the first 11 objects that take you from M77 to M45. Then you move toward the constellation Orion for M79 through 78, four more objects. We will be discussing each of these 15 objects over the next few minutes. That first chain of 11 objects, it begins with M77. That's a galaxy near the equator in the western sky, low near the horizon. It has a high surface brightness, so you can pick it up before the sky gets really dark. Some people have suggested beginning with M74 first, and I've tried that early in my days of doing the Messe Marathon, and I would find that I would spend so much time waiting to see M74 after I've centered it in my field of view as the sky gets darker and as it gets lower in the sky, that by the time I picked up M74, M77 had almost already set. So we suggest that you begin with M77 first. Once again, you can see it while there's still some twilight in the sky. And now you get to the toughest object on the list, that's M74. It's a tough object to pick up because it's a faint galaxy, it's diffuse, and it's low near the horizon. Now you have some time to find it, and keep watching the area as the sky darkens, but it is getting lower, until it pops into view. Now the third object is also tough. M33. It's a galaxy and it's large, but it has a very low surface brightness and tends to blend in with the background. You have a little more time to find and observe this one. After you've seen M33, the next three are grouped rather close together. It is the Andromeda galaxy, that is M31, and its two companions, M32 and M110. M31 and M32 are fairly easy. But M110, which is a fainter galaxy, more diffuse, is difficult to see at this low elevation in twilight. Through the last 40 years, as I've seen lists from amateur astronomers who have done the Messe Marathon and what objects they failed to observe, the most difficult object in the evening sky is M74. It's a faint galaxy diffused low in the sky, and that's what makes it difficult. Additionally, some amateur astronomers fail to see M33, again, a diffuse galaxy spread out over a large portion of the field of view. Sometimes someone will see the Andromeda galaxy, that is M31, and see its bright satellite galaxy M32, but will fail to see M110. For those of you trying the Messier Marathon in early April, and some years the moon's phase will force you to do it in April rather than late March, in that case, then M77 will also be missed. So once you've picked up the Messier objects, M77, 74, 33, and 31, 32, and 110, you can take a deep breath as you've seen the most difficult objects in the evening sky. And if you did not see them all, if they were too faint or had already set, then that's okay too. Mark down what you saw and what you didn't see, and you'll still have a wonderful and interesting night ahead. Next, we head north, and we find two open star clusters, M52 and M103 up by Cassiopeia. And then we swing south a little bit to the planetary nebula M76, which is fairly faint and small. Then over to the open star cluster M34, and finally M45, the Pleiades. Yes, you do have to see the Pleiades in your main scope, not just in the finder. The next string of objects starts in the south, with M79, a globular cluster south of Orion. Then we move up to Orion for M42, 43, and M78, which are all nebula. M42 is well known. It's known as the Orion Nebula, while M43 sometimes trips up some observers. It's the small appendage north of M42. We finish up with M78. So those are the first 15 objects in the Messier Marathon search sequence. You have the search sequence, and you have the map. When the moon gets out of the evening sky next week, you might want to practice going through those first 15 objects. Next week, we'll look at more Messier objects, and over the next 6 weeks, we'll cover all 110 in search sequence order. Once again, the related website for this podcast, where you can get all these star maps and the search sequence, is donmacholtz.com. That is spelled donmacholtz.com. Two H's. God willing and pod willing, I'll be back next week for another episode of Looking Up with Don. We'll discuss what's going on in the sky, more about the Messier Marathon, and I'll be discussing in detail my visual comet hunting theory, which I developed in the late 1970s. Thank you for listening. See the sky this week. I'll see you next week.